The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-à-vis its neighbor Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognized there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the US's unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the US out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the US is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The US invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. We are going to talk about the family-related issues according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about family-related issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And at the beginning of this episode, let me ask you this question. Is it permissible for women to clap in happy occasions like wedding and birthday parties? Assuming that it is permissible for the women to clap in such events, what if the sound of their clapping, goes out of their venues and it goes beyond and is heard by non-mahrams?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There's no problem in clapping in the manner which is generally accepted by common view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women can clap their hands and, express their joy or their appreciation. It is permissible per se, even if the sound actually is heard by non-mahram men, provided that it does not lead to any bad effects or bad consequences, negative mm-hmm. consequences.
Yes.
We cannot say it in a general, in a straightforward manner, and no religious authority has ever said that it is absolutely permissible. You know, if it does not lead to any vile consequences,
mm-hmm.
it is permissible per se.
I see. How about clapping in religious ceremonies? For example, normally accompanies these ceremonies, normally entails songs of praise for the Prophet and his household, and the recitation of salawat in birthday parties of the infallibles, for example, and other religious festivals. And would such a ruling or be different if these celebrations are held in places of worship, religious centers, such as masjids and prayer rooms in government departments and institutions?
Generally speaking, there is no problem in clapping in the way which is common in such celebrations. It is permissible per se, and it is it's considered to be a gesture of encouragement, or it's a form of approval of the activity that is going on, for example. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, has said that it is more meritorious, it is more virtuous to adorn these celebrations or these celebratory atmosphere with the sound of chanting salawat in the, on the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and of course by reciting Allahu Akbar and these are, especially recommended when such events take place. And especially in masjids and similar places. Of course, masjid has to be separated from other places because it cannot be compared with, let's say, government departments or institutions. Masjid is a holy place dedicated for prayer, for glorification, for praising Allah. So clapping.
And the difference is that special formula which is pronounced for it to be a masjid, right?
Yeah, of course. So it is if people want to clap their hands as a gesture of encouragement, they can do so in Husainiyas,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because Husainiyas are, or they call it Imam Barga in the Indian subcontinent. And this is Imam Bargas or Masaj or Husainiyas are dedicated for celebrations and these things. So the masjid has to be, used for worshipping, for praying, for reciting the Holy Quran. Mm. And of course, just as I said, it is more meritorious and more virtuous to recite salawat as a gesture of encouragement. And to recite Allahu Akbar.
Yes.
To chant Allahu Akbar.
Okay.
and it will be more meritorious.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, is still in the studio answering very nicely the questions that I raise about family issues according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, you know, what is the criterion for what we know as the fame clothes, better known as or otherwise known as Labas Shohra?
Yes. They are the types of clothes that are not suitable for wearing because of their color, because of their design, and because of maybe that the stitches, maybe because they attract the attention, you know. These could be some of the reasons which make a clothing forbidden to wear. Like the color is very flashy, it is eye catching, and if a woman wears that dress, she will definitely attract attention and people will follow or chase her.
Mm-hmm.
So the yardstick or the criterion is that when the person wears such clothes, they would definitely attract the attention,
mm-hmm,
on the attention of other people. And they attract the attention so much that their look would be kind of, haram look. They will continue looking at. Okay, sometimes you may see a woman,
mm-hmm,
with normal dress, that the dress is not attractive.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, new, it could be beautiful, but, you know, it has to be left and relegated to the society, to the common view.
Right.
Some dresses are really flashy, they are eye-catching. And it's not permissible for a man or a woman to wear such dresses.
Mm-hmm. I see. So quite related to that issue that you said, is it permissible for women, especially young women, to wear clothes that are in screaming colors, such as dark blue?
There is no objection to a woman wearing such such dresses in and, mm-hmm, of itself, you know, unless it attracts the attention,
mm-hmm,
of other people and leads to bad consequences. You know, dark color is good. So, you know, the color, you know, Islam is not opposed to the color, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a dress forbidden to wear is the design, and maybe that special color that is, mm-hmm, used, which is not common. And like, for example, red is very flashy. It attracts the attention. In Iran, for example, if a woman wears a dress in red and she comes out into the street, she will definitely attract attention. But in the Indian subcontinent, mm-hmm, if a woman wears red, it's a kind of normal dress,
mm-hmm,
and she will not attract attention. So it depends. It differs.
Depends on the culture.
Yeah, on the culture and from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation and the ruling may differ.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. For me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم.
In the limelight.
U.S. Republicans on House January 6 committee suggest the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas could be compelled to testify voluntarily about her involvement in Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled Cheney and Kinzinger Tee Up Possible January 6 Subpoena for Ginni Thomas. House January 6 committee could subpoena Ginni Thomas, the wife of the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, if she will not testify voluntarily about her involvement in Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The news from panel member Liz Cheney came 2 days after Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon was convicted of criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with the committee. He now faces time in jail. On Sunday, 24th of July, the second Republican on the committee, Adam Kinzinger, said, "You can't ignore a congressional subpoena or you'll pay the price." A warning, he said, applied to any future witnesses too. Liz Cheney, vice chair of the panel, told CNN's State of the Union program, "The committee is engaged with Ginni Thomas's counsel. We certainly hope that she would agree to come in voluntarily, but the committee is fully prepared to contemplate a subpoena if she does not." Ginni Thomas corresponded with Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff, and John Eastman, a law professor who shaped the congressional side of a push which culminated in the deadly Capitol attack. She also corresponded with Arizona Republicans about attempts to overturn Joe Biden's victory in that state. Her activities have added to pressure on her husband. The arch-conservative was the only justice to say that Donald Trump should not have to release records to the House committee. His wife's communications with the Donald Trump camp were subsequently revealed. Some on the left have called for Clarence Thomas to be impeached, a political non-starter. Liz Cheney said, "I hope it doesn't get to a subpoena. I hope Ginni Thomas will come in voluntarily. We've certainly spoken with numbers of people who are similarly situated in terms of the discussions that she was having, so it's very important for us to speak with her." Steve Bannon was convicted after a committee made a criminal referral to the Department of Justice. But in Mark Meadows' case, the Department of Justice declined to pursue charges. Adam Kinzinger told ABC's This Week program, "Those who defy subpoenas should face justice, right? Come in, you can plead the fifth if you want in front of our committee, but you can't ignore a congressional subpoena or you pay the price." Kinzinger added, "That's to any future witnesses too." Elaine Luria, the Virginia Democrat who with Adam Kinzinger presented the committee's case in a hearing on Thursday, 21st of July, told NBC's Meet the Press, "I don't think the Department of Justice can revisit something that they've already dismissed, but Mark Meadows is certainly someone who has probably more information than anyone, you know, other than the folks who we have already heard from who were in the White House on that day." Elaine Luria added, "If he's listening, we'd love to hear from him." Adam Kinzinger said. He thinks the panel has proved Donald Trump broke the law in his attempts to overturn the election. Liz Cheney would not go so far. She said, I think that Donald Trump's violation of his oath of office, the violation of the Constitution that he engaged in, is the most serious misconduct of any president in the history of the United States. Liz Cheney added, the committee has not decided yet whether or not we'll make a criminal referral. I would also say that the Department of Justice certainly is very focused. Based on what we see publicly on what is the largest criminal investigation in American history. She noted, but there's no doubt in my mind that the former president of the United States is unfit for future office. Elaine Luria said, I sure as hell hope the Department of Justice has a criminal investigation at this point into Donald Trump. She also said Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, has already told us he's listening, and if he's watching today, I'd tell him he doesn't need to wait on us because I think he has plenty to keep moving forward. The House Committee has held 9 hearings, 8 in the summer run, which ended on Thursday, 21st of July, with almost 3 hours on Donald Trump's inaction while the Capitol was attacked. There will be more hearings in September. Liz Cheney said more interviews were scheduled and the committee anticipates talking to additional members of the president's cabinet. We anticipate talking to additional members of his campaign. Liz Cheney added, certainly we're very focused as well as on the Secret Service. The deletion of Secret Service text messages from 5th and 6th of January 2021, despite an order from the committee to preserve them, is another flashpoint. Liz Cheney praised witnesses including Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Mark Meadows, and Sarah Matthews, a former White House press aide. Liz Cheney said, certainly, it is the case that the attacks against some of the women witnesses have been particularly vicious. I also think the response that we've seen from the House Republicans is really disgraceful. She added, I think our country is at a moment where we really have to all of us take a big step back and say, look, the normal, sort of vitriolic, toxic partisanship has got to stop, and we have to recognize what's at stake. And leadership of the Republicans and the House needs to be held accountable for their actions. Liz Cheney is expected to lose her seat in Wyoming over her opposition to Donald Trump. She would not be fully drawn on whether she plans to run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, when Donald Trump is expected to do so. Liz Cheney said, I've not made a decision about 2024, and I'm really very focused on the substance of what we have to do on the Select Committee. Very focused on the work and I have to do to represent the people of Wyoming, and I'll make a decision about 2024 down the road. She added, but I do think as we look towards the next presidential election, I believe that our nation stands on the edge of an abyss. And I do believe that we all have to really think very seriously about the dangers that we face and the threats that we face, and we have to elect serious candidates.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Principles of Friendship. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Dear listeners, I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and today we are talking about the principles of friendship. Under the principles of friendship, we have been talking about very specific topics that are very important for us to look at and are very important for us to know, to check on them and work on them in order for us to build a healthy, mature relationship and friendship. Now, today we are going to talk about how to achieve a successful friendship, how to be a successful friend. One of the main points that will lead us to be successful friends or will make us achieve a successful friendship is having good relationship. What does it mean by good relationship? Good relationship here means that whenever you are approaching your friend, you are approaching someone who you want to be your partner, who wants to be your partner, approach them with good relationship. Let me give an example, like smiling. Approach this particular person with a smile, with a good energy. This will definitely attract them to you and make them feel attached to you. Why? Because mostly people in this life have closed gates. People are living in a deprived kind of world. The life has become a bit, has become in a way that it makes people feel sad, feel less liked, feel less appreciated in the society. So the moment you approach someone with such an energy, with the smile, you are definitely attracting them to your side. Now, Imam Bakir alayhi salam has guided us with a saying by saying, smiling is a good manner, and open face is a source of attracting love and closeness to the Almighty Allah. Imam Bakr continues by saying, and frowning faces and bad manners is a source of hatred and remoteness from Allah. Whatever Imam is trying to tell us in this particular saying, the holy saying, is that we need to use smiling as a tool to attract people to us, as a tool to build up a good relationship between us and the people we want to be our friends. Smiling is a good thing, and the opposite of it, frowning, is a bad thing. Let's stay away from it.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and we've been talking about how to achieve a good friendship, how to achieve a successful friendship. Under the topic of how to achieve a successful friendship, we were talking about a good point that will help us achieve that particular friendship, and that is building up a good relationship, like smiling to people, approaching them with good energy, and so on and so forth. So what are the good of us building up a good relationship with people is that they are definitely going to affect the psychological part of the partners that we have, psychological part of the people that we consider as our friends. Now, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam guides us on how to associate with people so as to attract them and acquiring success in our relationship. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Do not try to attract people with your wealth. Attract them with an open face and a smiling face." What does it mean? Attract people with you having a good manner towards them, attract people with good energy, smile to them, show them love, show them that you're welcoming them. Not money. You can show someone money. Money really doesn't add up in anything as far as friendship and the inner feeling is concerned. Money really doesn't help us. It doesn't portray anything in terms of friendship and in terms of the world that we're living in and the world of the hereafter. Money is just, we could say that money is like something we use to reach to something, like a bridge for us to reach somewhere, to reach to our needs, to deal with our needs. But when you attract someone with money and you're attracting them to be your friend, definitely that particular friendship is never going to be successful. Why? Because the basis of the friendship is materialistic. You are giving them money to be your friend. So the day you'll stop giving them money, they'll stop being your friends. But how is smiling? Smiling is good. How is good energy? But having good energy towards them is good. You can have that throughout your life. An old person can do it. A poor person can do it. A rich person can do it. So we are advised to be having good relationship towards the people that we want them to be our friends by having good manners towards them, smiling towards them, and not materialistic things. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. Until next episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Limelight.
Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Derek Roche. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Trump and Pence Stump for Rival Arizona Candidates. Former President Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence held competing campaign events in Arizona on Friday, 22nd of July, as both publicly back rival Republican candidates for governor of Arizona. Thousands came to see Donald Trump at his rally in support of gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake at Findlay Toyota Center in the state's Prescott Valley, where the former president took aim at President Joe Biden. Mike Pence's visit to Arizona appeared to be more modest, as a crowd of around 300 people reportedly attended an event in Peoria at a store that manufactures tactical equipment. The former Vice President Mike Pence spoke in support of the gubernatorial candidate Karen Taylor Robson. Both Republicans are considered likely to run for the GOP presidential nomination in 2024. While Donald Trump has strongly criticized Mike Pence for his refusal to support efforts to overturn the 2020 election. The former vice president also visited the National Border Patrol Council's office in Tucson, Arizona on Friday. The Border Patrol Union has strongly supported Donald Trump but has endorsed Robson in the governor's race. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey joined Mike Pence and Robson at the events and the former vice president criticized Carrie Lake for previously supporting Democratic candidates. When you get out and vote for Karen Taylor Robson, you can send a deafening message that will be heard all across America that the Republican Party is the party of the future, Mike Pence said. He added, Arizona Republicans don't need a governor that supported Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. However, Mike Pence did not mention his break with former President Donald Trump or recent revelations from the House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the events of 6th of January 2021. Speaking at his Save America rally in Prescott Valley, Donald Trump criticized Doug Ducey as well as Joe Biden's handling of issues including inflation and offered his full support for Lake's gubernatorial bid. Trump said Doug Ducey is all talk and no action, and you'll see what can happen when Carrie Lake becomes your governor. It'll be like day and night. He did not mention his former vice president in his remarks, but criticized Arizona State House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a Republican who testified before the House Select Committee about Donald Trump's attempts to pressure him into saying the 2020 presidential election was fraudulent. Donald Trump called Rusty Bowers a rhino, a coward who participated against the Republican Party, and endorsed his Republican opponent in the GOP state Senate primary. The former president also warned that the United States could be heading for a recession, somewhat similar to the Great Depression that began in 1929. We've got to get this act in order. We have to get this country going, or we're going to have a serious problem, Trump added. Recent opinion polls suggest that Carrie Lake is the front runner in the race in Arizona. The current Real Clear Politics average of recent Arizona surveys shows that the Trump-backed candidate leading her Mike Pence-backed rival by about 8.5 percentage points. A survey carried out by OH Predictive Insights from 30th of June to 2nd of July showed Carrie Lake with a lead of 5 percentage points. The Trump-backed Republican had the support of 40% of likely GOP voters, compared to 35% who supported Karen Taylor Robson. An additional 21% were unsure, while the rest planned to back other GOP candidates who garnered single-digit support. The opinion poll included 515 likely voters and had a margin of error of plus or minus 4.3 percentage points. Trafalgar Group conducted an opinion poll from 14th to 16th of June that had Carrie Lake in the lead by double digits. The former television journalist was backed by 39% of likely Republican voters, and Karen Taylor Robson was supported by just 27%. More than 17% of respondents were undecided, and the rest supported other GOP contenders. The survey included 1,068 likely voters with a margin of error of plus or minus 2.9%. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, who has faced substantial criticism from Donald Trump, slammed Carrie Lake in a recent interview on CNN. According to Doug Ducey, who cannot seek re-election due to term limits in his state, Lake's entire campaign is an act. He said the GOP candidate has been putting on a show for some time now, and we'll see if the voters of Arizona will buy it. Conversely, he described Karen Taylor Robson as the real conservative. She's the real deal. She started her career working for Ronald Reagan. She's pro-gun and pro-life.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. God says that if you are grateful, He will certainly give you more. In another, He says, "And if you are ungrateful, My chastisement is truly severe." So both of these results are based on divine tradition, and it can work either way. Well, there are two cases referred to in chapter Al-Imran. It is strange that these two cases are both referred to in one chapter and are related to one event. Of course, there are two cases, but the two cases are related to one another. Two kinds of traditions are referred to: the tradition of victory and the tradition of defeat. One is in verses 173 of chapter Al-Imran. "Those to whom the people said, 'Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them.' But this increased their faith, and they said, 'Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee.' So they returned with favour from Allah." The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verses 173 and 174.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have probably heard this story. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shuhada, had been martyred in this battle. The Prophet had been wounded. The Commander of the Faithful had been wounded. Many people had been martyred. Tired, worn out, and wounded, they returned to Medina. The Quraysh, the same enemy who had failed to do anything, had struck a blow. But they had not been able to defeat the Muslims. They gathered outside Medina, just a few kilometers away from Medina, and said, "We will attack tonight. They are tired and won't be able to do anything. We will finish them off." Their agents went into Medina and started frightening people. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them." The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 173. They came and asked the people, "Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that." They, the enemy, was intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." They said, "No, we aren't afraid of them. God is with us." The Prophet asked those who had been wounded in Uhud that day to gather, and they did. He told them to go confront the enemy.
"Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puriza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners, who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League, the answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Miqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc.
From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual economic growth was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade.
Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.